the way I look at meditation is, I mentioned it before, so relax the body, relax the eyes, and don't go after the asanas. The moment the body is agitated again, it's no longer relaxed, is it? And the eyes aren't relaxed, and the mind's flowing out. So you've got to go back to the beginning, you've got to do your preliminaries again. So you just basically restart, you notice that you totally lost your meditation, everything's fallen apart, and so you just treat it like you're starting again. So start by relaxing the body. And
we
try not to. I mean, it's okay when you're first learning to practice, and at the end of the day, practice is in the mind. Mm-hmm. So, but learning the skill of being still is very useful, because the stiller we become, then the easier it is for our minds to settle down. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's like that. Reacting to things, reacting to pain, wanting to go after an itch, and all these things, we might do it out of unmindfulness, but also we need to just train ourselves in our meditation. But if we don't have happiness in our meditation yet, and we're just forcing our mind, then it can be quite difficult. But another way is you just go back to your meditation object. You just see the restlessness arising. You see that there's waves, and you just decide, okay, I'm not going to react to that. I'll just continue with my meditation object. You just go back. That's called substitution, which is the first of the five ways of dealing with destructive thought. And for example, like if I'm tired in the morning or something, you need to pick a meditation object that suits your current, you need to meditate in a way that suits the current moment. Like if you're really tired, doing laying down meditation isn't going to be the ideal thing to do. But, if you've got chronic back pain and you meditate as long as you could, then maybe you have to lie down. Meaning, you need to know, you need to be wise in the way that you do it. But for the restlessness, it depends on what the cause of it is. So you need to just see. But, the Buddha would teach, usually once we're meditating, to look at things as hindrances. So to get to know those hindrances, and there's two similes, two sets of similes for the hindrances. We have the books in the library, I can point it out. And basically you learn those similes and they're very useful. What's the one of the, I think restlessness and worry is like being a slave. Being free from restlessness and worry is like being free from slavery. So they're very powerful. And the other one I use, which the main one that I use, is the simile of the water. And I think restlessness and worry is just like waves and whirlwinds on the surface. And so you just see at the moment the mind is agitated. It wants to do this, it wants to do that. It's just an old habit. Just got to do what, it's like a child having a tantrum, it's just used to having those tantrums, and it wants things to be comfortable, it wants things the way that it wants it. But we try and teach our mind that, now's the time to meditate. Sometimes we get lost, sometimes we react because we're unmindful, but we just keep coming back and training ourselves, and the stillness and having a meditation object where we can allow the mind to settle in one point is useful, because that helps the mind unify. To begin with, you can follow the flow of the breath and spend time scanning the body. But ultimately, you want a meditation object that helps the mind unify, comes to one place. So all the other stuff is just trying to have some preliminaries that gets you in a good frame of mind. So by the time your mind's invaded with restlessness and it's a real problem, then either, contemplate the hindrance or come back and go through the preliminaries again. But if your meditation object brings you peace, then you just see, okay, hindrance is arising. And you come back to your meditation object. Just don't make it a problem. But like, I know, my mind is like this, and, this is happening, and it's terrible. But, these are just habits that we've got from lifetimes, Don't go away easily. So, that's a long answer about restlessness. There you go. So we'll start with the chant. Everybody got one? So the Metta Sutta.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, while missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
This is an excerpt from Ajahn Chah in the book Taste of Freedom that I actually had on my bookshelf as a layperson before I became a Buddhist, and I never even read it. but this is just an extract. The Buddha laid down morality, which is sila, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, which is panya, as the path to peace, the way to enlightenment. But in truth, these things are not the essence of Buddhism. They are merely the path. The essence of Buddhism is peace, and that peace arises from truly knowing the nature of all things. Another extract from page 44. So we say that a meditator should not walk the way of happiness or unhappiness. Rather, he should know them. Knowing the truth of suffering, he will know the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading to the end of suffering. and the way out of suffering is meditation itself. To put it simply, we must be mindful. Mindful is knowing, or presence of mind. Right now, what we are thinking, what are we thinking, what are we doing right now? What do we have with us right now? We observe like this. We are aware of how we are living. When we practice like this, wisdom can arise. We consider and investigate at all times, in all postures. When a mental impression arises that we know it as such. We don't hold on to it to be anything substantial. It's just happiness. When unhappiness arises, we know that. It's indulgence in pain. It's not the path of a meditator. This is what we call separating the mind from the feeling. If we are clever, we don't attach. We leave things be. We become the one who knows. The mind and feeling are just like oil and water. They are in the same bottle, but they don't mix. Even if we are sick or in pain, we still know the feeling is feeling, the mind is mind. We know the painful or comfortable states, but we don't identify with them. We stay only with peace, the peace beyond both comfort and pain. You should understand it like this, because if there is no permanent self, there is no refuge. You must live like this, that is, without happiness and without unhappiness. You stay only with the knowing, and you don't carry things around. So there are the two extracts from Ajahn Chah. They're pretty deep stuff. But the main idea is, you know, meditation, as Ajahn Chah said, you know, when we open our eyes, don't throw away your meditation. You know? So meditation is really mindfulness. And when can we be mindful?
All the time.
All the time, yeah, from when we open our eyes to when we fall asleep. So if we just meditate when we sit down, you know, with eyes closed, that's a very slow way of practicing. So what we do is we determine to practice in all postures. And, you know, to begin with, obviously, it's more difficult. But, you know, the word mindfulness has the word mind in it for a reason, because it requires to know where our mind is, to know what our mind is doing, to know what our mind is being attached to being averse to. And, you know, this is where suffering is arising. Just look when people get in pain, you know, all the how averse most people are to pain. You know, nobody wants pain in the body. They want a perfect body. But they haven't spent their time meditating, getting used to, you know, feelings and how the mind works. And so instead of the pain just arising in the body, the pain is arising in the mind. And I just think, you know, what would it be like if we had to lay in bed all day long and we couldn't move? Wouldn't it be in pain? So we all have pain with us, but we don't see it. Because we're constantly moving postures. And so because our bodies are constantly moving, we don't notice the pain. It's there all the time. And so when we come to practice, you know, we just build up slowly. So whether we start and it's just for 15 or 20 minutes or something, and in Buddhism there's this word called kanti, which is like enduring patience. And it's at the highest level, it means that somebody would come and chop off your arms and legs and you'd have a mind of equanimity. You wouldn't react to the pain. And the Buddha had a past life where that actually happened to him. A king had the executioner come and cut his body apart. And he said, no, pain isn't in my nose. You know, so patience isn't in my nose. Patience isn't in my arm. Patience isn't in my leg. Now, obviously, he was a serious meditator in that life. He didn't attain to that state over nothing. It shows you the power of the mind, that even in face of a terrible difficulty, a well-trained mind won't react. And so that's not even enlightenment yet. That's just the extent of spiritual parami and the extent of a well-centered mind. Usually, obviously that's an extreme case because that's the Buddha practicing to be a Buddha. And excellent beings like arahants and anagamis, they've probably trained to that level as well, because those beings have gone through the body, so they no longer identify with the body. They see the body just as elements, things that arise and things that pass away. And so when we come to meditate, at that time, it's an opportunity. It's like we are a monk or a nun. We're going to meditate to develop our minds. So we make the forest in our heart. If we can't get to an actual forest, an actual monastery, then we set up the forest in our heart. And at that time, we're not going to disturb anybody. We're not going to get involved with anything. And when thoughts of the past or the future come up, we just remind ourselves, death may come tomorrow, who knows? And now's the time to practice. I shouldn't be taking this time idly. If I died tomorrow, I would regret having wasted this time. And so we need to have skillful means to get a sense of urgency in our mind. Because if we're not taking things seriously, then, depending on the person, like some people may be inspiration, like reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha or the Dhamma, or just reflecting on peace. So we have a way that suits our mind of getting us interested in practice. Because if we don't get interested in practice, then what are we doing with our lives? Well, ultimately, when we die, what good have we brought further into our lives? Because we can't take our families with us, we can't take our house with us, we can't take our dinner with us, we can't take our pets with us. And at that time, we're going to have to deal with the suffering of letting go of all those things. So, the Buddha taught us to practice, but also to contemplate. And that's why I always recommend the teachings of Ajahn Chah, because he was somebody who was liberated through wisdom. And, where you use your sense contact in your experience, sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and mental impressions, you use those things to teach the mind. That you're just getting stuck in happiness, getting stuck in unhappiness, getting stuck in boredom and indifference. And none of those paths are the correct path. And so as we apply ourselves to the practice, it's a matter of finding how we can encourage ourselves. Because we can't just, be tough on ourselves all the time, and we can't be lazy as well. So we need to see, one teacher I listened to, Ajahn Thampu Don, used to say, if you can do Buddha for 15 minutes, then you should be like, yeah, well done. It was a good thing. Meaning that, to begin with, if we haven't really practiced consistently and we can't yet keep the mind sustained with our meditation, then we need to start slowly and gradually. And just like somebody learning to study, like I was saying last week, studying to be a doctor or something. Now, if they don't learn to focus their mind to study, they're never going to achieve their goal. So it's not a question of whether we can or not. It's the question of how we're going to do it. Because if we decide to do it, then it's not, it doesn't matter how long it takes us. It doesn't matter. So, but the best thing is to start small and then grow, So, if you start with 3-hour meditation, you might not want to meditate again for a month if that's your first meditation, or a year. So, but at the same time, once you can meditate for 15 minutes and then 20 minutes, and once that's comfortable, and then 30 minutes. And then so on. And then, once you can meditate for an hour, maybe learn some walking meditation or standing meditation. And then if you can only do a 20-minute meditation in the day, then spread it out and have a few, like 2-minute meditations. Are you just standing or sitting still and you just come back to your meditation object? Because the nice thing about meditation is you know what you're doing, you know. So when the Buddha taught mindfulness, there's a teaching called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the Greater Discourse of Mindfulness. And there's mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind state, mind, and mindfulness of Dhamma, of truth. And so the reason it's called the Supreme Path is it has everything in there. But to begin with, the Buddha said, you know, develop mindfulness of the body. You know, make that your vehicle, make that your basis. And so you have a selection of things in there, like awareness of body posture, awareness of the breath, some coarser meditation objects, like awareness of body parts, like head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, because this is where our attachment is in these bodies. So if you see some hair in the shower, is it beautiful? You stick it on somebody's head and you want to take them out to dinner. And so, you know, so sometimes having a coarse meditation object is useful because it quells desire, you know, because a lot of people, lust and greed and desire are a problem. So if you have a coarse meditation object like head hair, you know, your desire isn't going to arise at that time. But, you know, usually the breath, you know, is the recommended object that works for everybody. But if you can't get into breath, then, you know, we can go look at that teaching or ask experienced people and find a means to meditate for us. Because if imagine somebody training, as I said, to be a doctor, and, you know, it's halfway through the first year, and they haven't learned to memorize anything yet, you know. How well are they going to achieve in their exams? So, okay, you know, maybe they can go for 6 years and eventually get there. But it might be worth seeing if they can get some help. You know, see if there's another way for them to use their mind in a better way. And I think that's enough to begin with. We could do the meditation. And then after the meditation, we can have some questions, and I'll finish with a little bit more. So is everybody meditator? New meditation? Helen, you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So first thing we do, make sure we're in a comfortable position. So a position we think we can hold for half an hour. And, you know, like if you have problems in the knees or the back, then you just try and make a position. Like when I was first started, even when I was meditating a lot, sometimes I would do laying down. But I would make the bed on like a 45 degree angle. So I wouldn't fall asleep because I've got to a certain point where I could only practice so much. But the most important thing is the mind. So, you know, if you get to a point where you can't physically, you know, sit cross-legged, then you sit in a chair. And then if you can't sit in a chair, you know, eventually you may have to lay down. But ultimately, a good posture is better. Because when you have a good posture, you can have a bright mind. And then slowly, your posture will strengthen over time as well. So I always try and like lengthen the spine a little bit to help brighten the mind. And when I notice I'm getting dull in a meditation, you know, so it's like inspiration in the Buddha, have a bright mind. The Buddha means awake. So when we're meditating, we want to be awake. So once we've set up the posture, we just relax the body. Just bring our attention for every little particle of the body. Just bring relaxation throughout the whole body. Kindness, relaxation, welcoming. Coming into the present. Just relaxing the body. we set up this intention to meditate, and also just to be quiet in the meditation. We won't disturb other people if possible. And like we're on an island in our own heart, we don't have to worry about anything. Just put down the whole world, past, future, all of our problems, thoughts and anxieties. Just give them all up. Body relaxed. And we relax the eyes. Once again, you can notice there's lots of tension and restlessness in the eyes. This is all about busyness, all about getting involved, getting stuck in the world. And just relax the eyes. Body relaxed, eyes relaxed. Bring up a sense of goodwill towards ourselves and to all beings. May all beings be happy and free from suffering. Share this kindness with all beings. And we let all beings go. Now we just bring up our own minds. Just let the mind be with the mind, the heart be with the heart. Mind and the heart are the same thing. See, the mind wants to go out to sights and thoughts and all these things. This is where we just let go. Don't have to react. Just let the mind be with the mind, the heart be with the heart. So this is what we call the preliminaries. When we meditate, we always take the time to set the meditation up properly. And if we ever get really lost in the meditation, we just come back and do these things again. Now's the time we take up our meditation object. And if we're experienced, you can just let my voice be background noise. But for those who wish, give a guided meditation. First, we just come into the present. Just allow everything to settle. Just have a sense of welcoming and ease. Don't have to be in a hurry. There's no right or wrong. Just the willingness to try. Just be aware of an in-breath coming in and an out-breath going out. Try and choose a means which is comfortable to us. Some people like to watch the feeling of the upper lip, at the nostrils, roof of the mouth, the heart, the solar plexus, or the abdomen. We just choose one that we think feels comfortable. Stick with it for the meditation. In breath, it's the present moment. Out breath is the present moment. Trying to tune into the feeling of the breath. We're not looking with the eyes, looking with the mind, just aware of like the temperature, the feeling, the texture of the in-breath and the out-breath, or its chosen point of contact. Just this much. Just know there is an in-breath, there is an out-breath. feeling of the breath is good. We just stick with that for the meditation. Some people, it's easier with the mantra. So if we like a mantra, we can use the word Buddha, Bud, the in-breath, and Do, with the out-breath. We just say it at a volume and a pitch that's comfortable in our own hearts. Bud, Do. That's the explanation for meditation. We keep it very simple. Either the chosen point of contact, being with the comfortable feeling, and possibly a mantra. That's all. If the mind goes off, you just know it's gone off. When we're ready, bring it back. Start again. Put go. Chosen means, see if we can be aware of the whole of the in-breath, the whole of the out-breath. It's like we had a pencil and we were pointing something out. See if we can follow, be aware of all the parts of an in-breath and all the parts of an out-breath and our chosen point. Restlessness, doubt, whatever arises, just know it as a hindrance. Let it go. Don't believe anything the mind says. Let it all go. Come back to the meditation. mindful state in our hearts. We can try and tranquilize the in-breath and tranquilize the out-breath, letting the heart come to stillness, to unshakable peace, with our chosen theme of meditation. Like a good apprentice, just trying that's good enough. Give up all the hindrances. Throw everything out. Just be with the breath. I'll be silent for the next 10 minutes. see how the mind, how the heart is after half an hour of meditation. How we nurtured mindfulness, what our theme of meditation was, what preliminaries we used, if it worked or it didn't work, or if we had a distracted mind, how we managed to deal with it. So we can come skillful. Share a sense of goodwill with ourselves for the willingness to practice. Take the time to come here today. We need to encourage ourselves to see the good in developing the heart. If you want to rest in peace, the end, you're welcome to, for the rest of us, can open our eyes to end the meditation. So, how was that? Did that give rise to any questions? No. How did you find it? Okay. Monkey mind? Oh, pretty good.
A little bit.
A little bit. That's okay. It's like in one of the Dhammapada verses says that the untrained mind is like a fish thrashing in shallow water. So if the Buddha said that, where people say they can't meditate, we just have to remind ourselves we haven't trained our mind yet. So our attempts to training our mind will eventually bear fruit. So we just need to have a good attitude. So we keep trying. And then the more we try, some days the bucket overflows and when we have lots of peace. Or we have some wisdom arise. And but other times things are more difficult. I know one monk and who had excellent meditation in his first year in a monastery in Thailand. And then one year his mind was just thinking all the time. And even though, you know, he had great spiritual parami from past life and he already practiced well. But the thing is, we've got to realize that thinking is not a problem. You know? So thinking can give rise to wisdom. So we just got to make it, you know, when a thought arises, it's just like a sound arising. If you get angry at the sound, it's not very wise. I mean, the sound hasn't done anything to hurt you. So the idea is with our thoughts. The problem is that we believe them. We believe the thought that this happened in the past and this is going to happen in the future and you've got to make dinner tonight. And then, you know, this happened at work and you said this to this person. But actually, that none of that is true because the past is gone and the future is yet to come. So it's not that we don't think and we don't look at things. But, you know, we say, you know, okay, at this day, at this time, I'm going to sit down and, you know, decide what I'm going to do for the week. And this time, you know, I'm going to talk with my husband and this time I'm going to do this. And so you use your mind in a wise way, but if you just let the mind be like a monkey running after the forest, the monkey doesn't know what it's doing, it's just jumping from branch to branch. And so this is why meditation is difficult to begin with, because the monkey doesn't want to be tied to a post. And then the other thing is, it's like the difference, because what we're really training for is samadhi. And so the higher stage of samadhi, even if we don't attain to it in this life, or even before we get enlightened, I'm sure maybe in the last stage of enlightenment, you probably have samadhi. But the idea is, samadhi means like the mind unifying in peace, basically. At that stage, the mind stops. And then, so it's a pretty refined state. So that's like, say, that's the goal. But when we're meditating, all we've got to remind ourselves is that whatever is arising that's trying to stop us from meditating, it's just defilement. And what I was going to say is, it's like the soft wind versus the harsh wind. So there's a monkey on a branch, and there's these two winds. There's a soft wind and a harsh wind, and they're talking to each other. And the harsh wind's like, oh, I can knock this monkey off the branch. And the soft wind's like, okay, go for it. And the harsh wind blows and blows and blows and blows. It just makes the monkey hold even tighter onto the branch. You know? And eventually, you know, the harsh wind gives up because, you know, it's been blowing for an hour and nothing. So then the soft wind's like, okay, now it's my go. And softly blows, very softly, softly. And eventually the monkey gets lulled to sleep and falls off the branch. And that's deep meditation. So one day, this is our goal, is we just keep practicing. And, you know, if we're Buddhists, having faith in the Buddha, like the Buddha has the recollections, like a recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. These are things that bring inspiration into the mind. And, you know, I use the Buddha and the Sati regularly, because without inspiration, it's easy for the mind to be dull. It's easy to get tired. You know, it's easy to feel that, oh, maybe I won't meditate now because, you know, my body is sore and all these things. So inspiration is a very useful tool to develop. And it's a way of, it's like the difference between an apprentice who is really enthusiastic and an apprentice, you know, who's a bit dull and not interested. So that's my kind of understanding of meditation, that it's not, doesn't matter really the contents of your meditation, but it's just your ability to keep trying. Sometimes painful feelings arise, you know, sometimes really difficult thoughts arise, and these are just like that sound, you know, how do we react to the sound, how are we going to react to these things? And as we meditate more, what we see is that these things can no longer invade our mind. You know? And so this is the idea of, you know, the Buddha said, be an island unto the Dhamma, be an island unto yourself. We're getting this point where that the luminous heart is the mind that's not involved with the world. So it doesn't get involved with things. And I better stop for a question. Any question to finish up? How'd you find meditation? Good? Excellent. Yeah. Question. Question, huh?
Buddho. Could you, what's the meaning behind Buddho?
Well, if you want to do it in English, it would be awake. 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 It's the main epithet for the Buddha. So the Buddha's, any epithet for the Buddha will do, like kinsman of the sun, the great sage, the peaceful one, any quality of the Buddha that inspires your mind. But Buddho is the classic word they use in Thailand. And so when I do the Buddha Nusati, I usually use some investigation sometimes, you know, to get inspiration. Because if you don't have inspiration in your meditation object, then you're just kind of perfunctorily doing it like you did it yesterday, and you're not really there. So quality over quantity, you know, you want to remind yourself that to have mindfulness, you know, you've got to be interested in what you're doing. And so the word Buddha is just a simple mantra to have as a meditation object, and also through the day. So you're washing the dishes, you know, you're walking somewhere, you're doing something, you just use your meditation object, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. And to begin with, maybe you can only do it for 10 minutes in a day. And the next week, 20 minutes. The next week, an hour. The next week, 3 hours. And eventually, what you're doing is cutting your mind out from proliferation. You know, because proliferation, so when we meditate, it's mindfulness of the body, whatever meditation object we have, it's like tying our six senses to a post. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, all tied to a post. That's meditation. The mind isn't straying, doesn't get attacked by all the external things, including thoughts. It's just with its meditation undisturbed. So that's the goal, that's sense restraint. But what usually happens is these six animals are tied together. And so you see a sign. And so that animal drags all the other animals off over there. And then you hear a sound and all the animals get dragged over there. And then you think a thought about it and all the animals get dragged over there. So they're all tied together by a knot. And so by the time we get to the end of the day, our minds are exacerbated and worn out and tired and agitated and restless because we've just proliferated all day long. So the real precursor to meditation is sense restraint. So what we're really doing, you know, we have the precepts and generosity and watching our mind and moods. So, you know, don't try not to allow hate to arise. Try not to allow, you know, excessive lust and these kind of things to arise in the mind. That's just watching the mind. But beyond that, we need to train in mindfulness. And so that's basically developing the sense restraint. Because until we have strong sense restraint, where these animals are tied to the post, we're not really actually meditating. Because we don't have a powerful enough mind to give rise to wisdom. We're still practicing and developing wisdom, and it's good, but the true wisdom comes from samadhi, comes from one-pointedness. And, anyway. So samadhi is translated as concentration. But, you know, concentration has a bad rap as a word, but, you know, somebody who's, you know, made well use of their mind, you know, when they... Like, as I was saying, somebody who studied, their concentration isn't a difficult thing. You know, or the memory champions, their concentration isn't a difficult thing. So concentration just means that your mind can be one-pointed in its chosen thing. And you have strength of mind. And so that's why I say it's good just to build up slowly. You know, whether you do 5 minutes twice a day, 15 minutes twice a day, or whatever, build your ability to be with your meditation and watch your mind. You know, even if you have to look at the clock 10 times, so what? You know, at least you sat there and tried. And then, you know, it gets easier with time. And then you can come to things like this and ask questions. And in time, you know, things start making more sense. And, you know, some people, maybe it takes many lifetimes. Maybe this is the first lifetime you've come to meditate. So it's more difficult. Now, other people, maybe they've meditated for many lifetimes. So they start meditating and things are easier for them. Now, other people, maybe they've, you know, killed in a previous life, so they're going to have a lot of sickness in this life. And so it doesn't matter what arises, the fact that we're human, and we have the ability to practice, now what else are we doing with our life? What else is important? Now, other things are useful, but by the time we come to our end of our life, you know, whether we've developed our mind or not, it's going to be important. So, a bit off track of your question. Is there one last one?
Me?
Yeah? Somebody? Sarah, you have a question?
Not really.
Rodney?
No.
Yeah. Okay, one more.
It's about right speech.
Yeah? Right speech is difficult.
Yeah.
So there's a thing called the 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action. So you can just type that into Google, 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action. So it's basically an extension of the 5 precepts. So the 5 precepts finish with the, you know, abstention from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and drugs and alcohol that cause heedlessness, where the 10 unwholesome courses of action are killing, abstention, wholesome course of action are abstention from killing, abstention from stealing, abstention from sexual misconduct, abstention from lying, abstention from divisive speech and gossip, abstention from harsh speech, abstention from idle chatter, and then it goes into the mind, abstention from thoughts of covetedness, like desiring your neighbor's Ferrari or whatever you for a monk, desiring a special pen or whatever. Yeah, that's covetedness. Thoughts of anger. So you abstain from all thoughts of anger. And then thoughts of wrong view. Meaning we need to learn the teachings of the Buddha. So the four right speeches. So we start with lying. So lying is that, you know, if a king and his ministers came to you and you were put up in front of him, they said, come now, tell the truth. You know, what happened at this time? And then knowingly you lie. So that's a deliberate lie. But then the most refined form of lying is not even lying for a joke. Like, you know, you hide something from a friend and then say, you know, because you're just kidding around with them. You've got a serious face and you tell them, you know, you don't know where it is or whatever. You're deliberately lying, but it's just as a joke. You know, so that's the spectrum. So the first one is make sure you never lie deliberately. And then the last one means you need to be conscious of all your speech, so you'll never even do that. So it's a big spectrum. And then divisive speech means that you don't divide people. So are you bringing harmony? Or maybe you don't say that speech. So I've got to be careful sometimes because, you know, sometimes you speak about people and it comes out, you know, in a wrong way. So that kind of speech you probably shouldn't have said. Even if you didn't mean it like that, what is the result of your speech? Because if your speech divides people, maybe it wasn't worth saying. But it doesn't mean it's not in line with wisdom, like if you're just speaking the truth, like, you know, oh, that person did this. But you're not saying it out of malice. You're not saying it to divide people. So it's time and place. So you've got to look at the intent behind your speech. Then harsh speech. Well, harsh speech is pretty obvious. You bludgeon idiot. Or whatever it is that you're saying. So saying words with the mind of malice, basically. And then idle chatter. Well, that's very refined. But first it starts with giving up rambling speech. So, you know, it's like eating a healthy dinner compared to eating packets of chips all day. And there's a big difference. So one is going to give you nutriments and the other is going to make you live a short life. And there's a simile in the Jatakas in the past life of the Buddha. And it's like the speech. So there's a simile of a chariot and how the chariot is put together will mean whether it rattles or not. And so the chariot that rattles is like somebody with idle chatter. And another simile for idle chatter is like a fish. You know, the fish's mouth going up and down. That's idle chatter. And basically it's all worldly talk. So it's quite refined because lay people, it's basically a form of entertainment. You know. So by the time a being is enlightened, they've given up all idle chatter. They're no longer interested in anything other than the Buddha's teachings, talking about meditation. They might ask you how you're going, you know, if you've had enough food and so on, but they won't talk about weather and kings and all these things, unless it's in a particular situation for a very short period of time. You know, they wouldn't. So all of those normal kinds of speech, totally useless for spiritual practice, you know. The questions about land and sea and talk about dead relatives and all these kind of things. They just talk. So, but the reason why they're staged like that is, you know, even by the time somebody reaches the first stage of enlightenment, they will have to be able to at least hold their tongue when they're practicing. But it's not until the higher paths that they've necessarily practiced to be able to permanently eradicate those things. So serious practice does, because just think about it, if you talk a lot, what's going to happen in your mind? You're going to think a lot. Thinking a lot and talking a lot go together. But that's, So that's a really good, that's why I usually prefer that than the precepts, because it's teaching you to start looking at your mind.
Anyway, it's 4:37, so we better finish now with the final chant.
Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and illusion be dispelled.
Vidyo viva chantu sa paroko vina sattu mate pavan tuan tarayo suki dika yuko pava apiva tanna sili sani changku ta pachayino chattaro dhamma vatanti ayuvano sukhang. Okay. So, may you be well and happy and continue with your practice bit by bit, no matter how difficult. Okay.